in fellowship. I'm not sure you can be if you're a Miami fan, but you never know. Grace may cover a lot more than we recognize. All right, we are here on the last page, page 10, under subpoint Roman numeral 6, subpoint C, or P rather, I'm sorry, P, not C. dealing with the fact that the believer, we just looked at the fact that there are certain principles which you cannot play off against the doctrine of separation in order to get out of, again, father, mother, marriage. But these get to the divine institutions at some level. One cannot blow those off with an appeal to this doctrine. This doctrine may have its time and place for application, and it certainly does, but in certain cases it is not to be applied or appealed to as a way of getting out of certain other responsibilities. So P, the believer must understand and believe the principle that God will establish sound relationships with other positive believers. And these are the relationships that ultimately are satisfying. And then this gets into the principle of patience also as well. We recognize that fellowship is not something that one can crank up or should crank up. And so we don't have a fellowship hall. Well, we don't have anything, but that's okay. But if we did have, we wouldn't have a fellowship hall. Because this idea of putting people together in contrived situations and, quote, forcing fellowship is not good. It's gross. That's fundy. We're not for that. You have to wait and let God establish relationships. And you may go through periods of life. And you have to be willing to go through these seasons of life. We saw there in Ecclesiastes, Solomon talks about all these different seasons in life, these different times. And you have to be willing to go through them. And you may go through a period where you endure relative isolation for some time. And your only real fellowship at that level is with God. Okay, that's the way it has to be. But that's also good for you spiritually at a certain level to learn how to stand on your own two feet, function on your own, have a relationship with God. And then when God does provide, if you develop capacity with life, or for life, with a relationship with God, then when God does provide other relationships, they will be satisfying. One does not have to crank these up. And I've been through periods in my life where I've had plenty of friends and I could see anybody I wanted to see at a certain time and it was all great. I've been through other periods where there's relative isolation and loneliness, but not loneliness that can't be dealt with under doctrine, but it is real. That you may not always have fellowship every moment and you just have to recognize that God will provide the right relationships at the right time and be patient. And be open to them. That's another whole thing. Again, you're not to use this doctrine. Well, I've separated from everybody. I'm a recluse. No, that's not what God wants in life. Clearly, Solomon also articulated that two are better than one and three are better than two. That there is a point in which some companionship makes a big difference. But one cannot, again, play this off of this doctrine and say, well, I don't have associations with anybody because I've separated from everybody. Well, there's something wrong there. And on the other hand, you have to be willing to wait. And then I've had times where I've gone through, there were certain people, I was closer friends with them for a period of time, for 3, 4, 5 years, whatever. And then that relationship kind of waned for whatever reason. You can't be grabbing on to, I've got to have people around me in order to survive. You have to have some iron in your soul and be able to survive spiritually at some level on your own. And then when God provides fellowship and these other blessings, and the fellowship really only comes as a result of unity in doctrine. There isn't going to be fellowship otherwise. One has to embrace the truth at a certain level in order to have fellowship with those that embrace the truth. And those that don't embrace the truth, well, they don't have fellowship truly. They may have some, quote, relationships out there, but they really don't have true fellowship because they don't have a unity of viewpoint. And the very word fellowship, koinonia in the Greek, means to share something in common. What you share in common is doctrine, of course. Well, Q, marriage and the doctrine of separation, one, under the principle that forbids being unequally yoked together. Believers are not to pursue or establish relationships with unbelievers of the opposite sex. That is a hard and fast rule. Now, do believers do it? Sure. Do they get away with it? Maybe. I don't know. I don't tend to stick around and see how it all works out 20 years down the road, or 5 or 10. One of the things is that when we were studying Genesis, well, it became very clear, both in the life of Abraham and in the life of Isaac, that they neither one of them believed their child should marry a Canaanite. And essentially, the land is inhabited, as it were, with Canaanites. The world is inhabited with Canaanites. And so if you pursue a relationship with a Canaanite, that's all you're going to end up with, it's a Canaanite. And these people are enemies of God, they are off limits and all of that. So there is no place for this. Do not establish relationships with unbelievers, because there's no point in it. It's a violation of your royal imperatives. You are failing as an ambassador. You are failing under your spiritual priesthood. I mean, this is a big one. And in certain areas of life, certain things, marriage, one of them, that can have such a far-reaching effect on you and on your life that you better be careful about this one. Two, since positive believers are to avoid fellowship with negative believers, obviously one would not begin dating a negative unbeliever with a view to marriage. That, to me, is just an extension of the principle. The principle is you don't marry a negative unbeliever. An extension of the principle is it wise to marry a negative believer? No, you're still going to have conflict in the house. You're still going to have trauma. You're still going to have all the issues that you would have with an unbeliever at a certain level. Only the negative believer will feel justified in their stupidity. So this is not what you want. God has called us to peace. That's what Paul says. And so what you want to do is, one, what will, as it were, grease your skids spiritually, give you the best chance to be, if you need to be with someone, to be with someone who's positive, who wants the truth, and all that. But again, this idea of missionary dating, dragging them into class, well, we'll see if they're positive. I'm going to date them and we'll see if they're positive. No, see if they're positive before you start dating them. That makes far more spiritual sense to me. Now, how are there exceptions to this? I suppose there are, but I couldn't tell you who they are. I haven't met anyone that this has really worked with long term when they violate these principles. So the challenge is, okay, you've got to be committed to these, because failure in this can have, again, some long-term and lasting repercussions. Three, all believers must learn to wait on the Lord, and it is no more true than in the second divine institution of marriage. That is the deal where faith rests, and again, patience is called for. Faith rests, waiting on God, and let God work it out. And that's where patience is necessary. You have to, okay, now God, you know what I want. You know my heart. Now, certainly you should be praying about this all the time if you're in this situation. This would be a constant thing on the prayer list. Further, remember, it is better to be single, fulfilling God's plan and time, than it is to compromise doctrine and get into a relationship that may become a real cause of grief. Proverbs 11:22, and we wouldn't wish that on anybody. There's enough grief in life without having to deal with a traumatic marriage. I mean, it's a part of some believers' testing and their niche, and we understand that. But again, it's not anything I would wish on anybody. Proverbs 11:22. As a ring of gold in a swine's snout, so is a beautiful woman who lacks discretion. And unfortunately, as we know about men, me being a man and all, I have some insight. But we know about men, they're taken in by the overt package. If it's cute, well, that's fine. That's all that we really need, isn't it? I mean, and men, you know, they're going to look typically. And younger men are even dumber about this than older men. Older men have at least learned, well, geez, she may have an over great package, but the product is moldy inside, or worse. And so the longer you live, the more you recognize, and I think we heard the voice of Solomon on this, what kind of woman you could end up with in Ecclesiastes, the woman whose hands are snares, and all of that, whose heart is snares, and whose hands are hooks or whatever it was, but that's not what you want. So, but again, younger men tend to be goofy about this. They tend to look at the package. Oh, she's hot. And guess what? She's not going to be hot forever. This is something young people don't seem to realize. The overt package fades. Beauty fades. Charm is beauty. Charm is deceitful, and beauty is vain, because it all fades. And then when it fades, what are you going to have? If you don't have a woman that's really serious about doctrine, well, what are you going to end up with? Some high-maintenance woman? Well, no, that's not what you want. Proverbs 21:9 also. So you can get a beautiful woman, but you can also get a pig. Put a gold ring in both their snouts, and who knows? Proverbs 21:9, it is better to live in a corner of a roof than in a house shared with a contentious woman. And we could reverse this. It's better to live in a corner of a roof than in a house shared with a contentious man. So it's true both ways. So you want a person, obviously, who's not contentious, who's not this type of person, who's going to argue over everything. For one thing, life's too freaking short to argue over everything. And I've watched people waste a lot of time just arguing over nonsense, non-essentials. Also, verse 19, it is better to live in a desert land than with a contentious and vexing woman. Now, if you get some of these shows, like on Discovery Channel, or in some of the other ones, like you see Bear Grylls and all that. Well, I see them living in the deserts and eating worms and scorpions and drinking water out of a camel's stomach in order to survive. He says it's better to have that than to live with the wrong woman. Or, alternately, of course, the wrong man. Here with a contentious and vexing woman. One of the things, of course, if marriage isn't right, it can become as vexing as any relationship on the planet. And it's hard enough even in its good times. I mean, we recognize that marriage is a wonderful thing. God's provided it for the blessing, as we saw, of the human race. But there are times when it's just flat-out work, and it has to be worked at by both parties, and it isn't easy. And we've never said it would be easy. And so if it's difficult under the best circumstances, how much harder is it going to be if you do it wrong? Marry the wrong person, violate the doctrine, on and on. I wouldn't want that. And then you got grief. Then you got discipline possibly on top of that. I don't want any of that. I can get enough discipline on my own. I don't need to create relationships to cause me discipline. And if it's difficult under the normal circumstances, how much harder would it be if you're doing it all wrong? As Peter said, it's now time for judgment to begin at the household of God. What's going to happen to the unbeliever and the sinner? And God's going to scorch his own people first, read Bema's seat. And if he's going to do that first, how are these other people going to end up? And I believe fully that that judgment at the Bema seat will be merciless. I mean, it's going to be right along the lines of righteousness. God's not going to cut anybody slack at that level, I don't think. You're going to get what you get. And if that's if it's hard enough for us to just get into phase three and get there correctly, and then how much more difficult is it for the negative person? Well, odds aren't good. Chapter 27, verse 15 also. A constant dripping on a day of steady rain and a contentious woman are alike. He who would restrain her restrains the wind and grasps oil with his right hand. Well, you can't carry oil very far. I mean, you carry a little bit, I suppose. But his whole point is it just runs through your fingers. It's uncontrollable. And there's a certain type of woman who's uncontrollable, this contentious woman. And I've met women like this, and boy, they're gross. I'll give you that. Solomon knew what he was talking about. I don't like being around them. The harpies, the shrews, the constant nagging, finding fault with everything. Everything's a problem. I really like it when I see women and they treat their husbands like they're just idiots in public. That's always fun. You know, you little idiot. Well, it's not appropriate, and it's not becoming for the female to be that way. So they're a constant dripping on a day of steady rain. We've all heard the drip. The Chinese water torture is what this woman is. Drip, drip, drip. And on and on. And we saw there, and I didn't put it in here, but Ecclesiastes also, the one, verse I alluded to earlier, chapter 7, verse 26, I discovered more bitter than death. The woman whose heart is snares and nets and whose hands are chains. And again, this is not all women, this is just a particular type of woman. So one would be well suited to figure out who one was, what one wanted, and know who the other person was before, again, entering into this relationship. So separation will save you some trouble. Five, again, the real blessings in life come to those that honor God and apply His word to these issues. Proverbs 19:14. And I'm assuming, as a positive believer, that's what you want, the real blessings in life. I like mine with certainly a minimum of discipline. I'd like to say I don't get any discipline, but that's not true. With a minimum of discipline and a lot of blessing, that's kind of the life I like. House and wealth are an inheritance from the fathers, but a prudent wife is from the Lord. And Proverbs, and I'm not going to read all of it, but 31:10 following talks about the virtuous woman, the type of woman you want. She works hard, she takes care of things, she's faithful, she's loyal, she has a good reputation, she is generally kind, strength and dignity are her clothing, she has wisdom, she has doctrine, she has the ability to do all these things, and she does them, and she, her heart is in it, and she wants to. That's the kind of woman you want. Not the woman that, fix me some dinner, all right, there's some cornflakes in there and some milk. The best you can. There's some leftovers. It might be moldy, but you eat it. It's fine. Well, no, that's not the kind of woman you want. The kind of woman that doesn't clean the house. The kind of woman that doesn't take care of her responsibilities. That doesn't do all that. Well, no, you don't want that woman. And you certainly don't want to be that woman. So six, if a believer is married to a spouse who is negative but does not attempt to interfere with the intake and application of doctrine, the believer is to remain in the marriage. We saw that in this 1 Corinthians passage, where you are to stay if the person is negative. We recognize that certain things we cannot control as believers. And you can't use, again, separation to get out of, well, this person, I don't think they're right. My right man, I don't think they're positive. My right woman, whatever. Whatever the excuse is, these verses pretty well put an end to that. They pretty well spell out God's directive will here. And it's the same will that Jesus had taught and was taught even early on in Genesis, why God created one man and one woman. To the rest I say, not the Lord, if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he must not divorce her. Again, by extension, if God expects the positive believer to stay with a negative unbeliever, would he not expect the positive believer to stay with a negative believer? To me, that's the lesser of the two evils. Now, granted, they can become worse, I understand that, depending upon their level of culpability, how hostile they are, and all of that. But if they attempt to interfere with the intake and application of doctrine, I'm going to apply. No, you're not. Oh, yes, I am. Then the wife has to, would have to seriously consider that, or the husband, too. I've seen this go both ways, where the wife was negative and the husband was trying to pursue class, and then finally it came down to the demand. It's me or that church. See, that made it easy. See, that makes it easy. But most people won't do that. They won't make it easy on you. So if you had to stay again with a negative unbeliever, it's my contention you would be expected to stay with a negative believer. Although the verse doesn't directly address that, I understand. But I think it's a logical conclusion from the principle. And a woman who has an unbelieving husband and he consents to live with her, she must not send her husband away. Again, read divorce there. That's the point. Unfortunately, or fortunately, this is the way God's plan is. And people don't have these easy outs that they might like to think they do. And so, again, as we've said, I've said for years, since I've started teaching, divorce is not to enter your vocabulary. Now, if you got a negative spouse and they instigate it, you can't stop it. But you just have to be committed to the marriage and let the chips fall where they may, and God will either deliver you or not. And He may deliver you. Maybe you're married to somebody who's negative, unbeliever, and they finally just say, that's enough. I'm sick and tired of this doctrine stuff. I don't want to hear it. Yeah, puke, puke, puke. I'm leaving. Well, then if they do, they go. That's fine. You're free in that case. Again, you have to until they go out and do something dumb, which probably won't take long for most people. They're going to go out and blow it, and then you're free to do what you want to before the Lord. As, of course, within the bounds of doctrine and what we see in marriage and in this doctrine, separation. 7, however, if a negative spouse makes it impossible for a believer to consider his or her pursuit of the truth, that believer can appeal to the higher principle and legitimately disobey. But they have to be commanding you essentially to sin. It can't just be some command you don't like. They have to be getting in the way of specifically either intake or application. I'm applying doctrine in this case. No, you're not. Oh, yes, I am. I have the right under my priesthood to apply doctrine. You can't play God over me. You can be my husband or my wife, but you can't play God over me. This is a part of my priesthood. You still have to, everybody has to allow for that for volition. That's divine institution number one. And if the negative spouse doesn't want to allow for that, they have crossed the line at that point. And so you have to figure out, okay, what is tolerable, what is intolerable, what is acceptable, what is unacceptable, and all of that. Well, Roman numeral 7 here, conclusions. There can be no doubt that the doctrine of separation is taught throughout the Bible. And in fact, in many cases, I was stunned when I was doing the book of Genesis, and I did some research. I didn't teach the books. But I'd done some research through the rest of the Pentateuch, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And I'm stunned throughout the Old and the New Testament even, how many times separation is an issue. Be it geographical separation, be it physical separation, be it spiritual separation. I'm stunned at how many of the pages of the Bible this doctrine is found on. At least I was stunned. I'm not stunned anymore. But this is an issue brought on by the nature of the angelic conflict. And since we know the angelic conflict permeates pretty much everything, we might expect this doctrine to be that critical. And we would. And again, this doctrine, seriously, for those of you who have not been around doctrine for a long time, those of us who have been have seen it, people use this more often than any other doctrine to peel off. They say, this is unacceptable. I don't have to do this. I don't have to apply this. Why? Because the fundies won't teach this doctrine. This is not in their repertoire at all. And again, even to the extent it is, it's weird. You know, they have it under shunning and various other things. But they don't have the principle straight. And they couldn't give you the exceptions when it's okay not to separate or you don't have to separate. Or the exceptions when you aren't allowed to separate, even though that might be what you spiritually want to do. They're not going to deal with all of these subtleties in it. And again, that's the nature of the beast is the Bible is, if you put it all together properly, it's fairly subtle. There are these complementary things that interact with one another, and you have to know what they are. B, there are several reasons, sound reasons, to apply this doctrine when it becomes necessary. One, to protect you and your family from corrupting influences. 1 Corinthians 15:33. And this is just a general principle, sort of a proverbial expression Paul throws in here, that would very much fit within the book of Proverbs, in fact. Do not be deceived. Don't be fooled on this one. Bad company corrupts good morals. That's the danger under separation, is that the corrupting influence can drag you down and eventually wear you down. That's the nature of negative volition. It pounds against the positive believer over the course of his Christian life from time to time. Not like it's every day. But sometimes it's more intense than at other times. And just the constant wear and tear on you of having the cosmos pulling at you, having negative believers pulling at you, having negative unbelievers pulling at you. Then you've got to fight, your own STA and the unseen enemies, Satan and his hordes, the demons. And so, again, if this corrupting influence wasn't real, we would say, okay, this doctrine's not an issue. But the fact is, the corrupting influences are real. People become like that which they believe and like that which they worship. And when people have embraced false doctrine, they're going to eventually come to false conclusions. They're not ultimately going to make the adjustments that they need to make. Well, two, it's an attempt to bring the maladjusted to their spiritual senses. In 2 Corinthians there. And in this case, it was under the principle of the incestuous believer engaged in this sexual relationship with his stepmother. And the goal of putting him out of the church was to get him to recognize, you know, you are messed up. You are so messed up that it's unacceptable any longer. You've crossed this line. We'll tolerate under grace a certain amount of stupidity. But once you cross the line, and every believer has to figure this out, that there comes a point at which grace ends up here. Now, if you stay down here under the big umbrella of grace, you can be dumb, you can flirt with the line. I wouldn't recommend it. But if you cross the line, it becomes unacceptable. You're no longer under the principle of grace. Now you're under judgment. Say like the incestuous Corinthian was. Say like the factious man was. Say like these other people. Say at some level, even say the prodigal son. His father didn't go chasing after him. He let him go off and do his thing. To his own destruction, in fact. But obviously the father graced him out once he came back. Well, that's the principle for us. Even if somebody gets out into here, and they're no longer under the principle of grace, but under judgment. Well, guess what? They can return. They can recover. They can get back if they choose to. But there comes a point at which, okay, all right, this becomes unacceptable. Jesus didn't say in the name of grace to tolerate this Jezebel. He said the fact is you do tolerate her, and that's the problem. Certain things are not to be tolerated in doctrinal churches. And unfortunately, that's the sad reality of the angelic conflict. Well, once a person crosses this line, as the incestuous Corinthian did, the goal of putting them out is to say, hey, you need to get back here. That's the goal. Now, they may never see that. They may never do it. In his case, the incestuous Corinthian did. He got the picture, which means, obviously, there was a certain amount of positive volition there among his in his life that hadn't really manifested itself at that level yet. And certain believers may have to go through certain things. And God may have to kick the living daylights out of them. We all sing that song, Drop Kick Me Jesus Through the Goalposts of Life. And God will do it. God's not afraid to do it. God will break bones. God will kill people. God will take eyes out. God's not worried about it. And God does it with surgical precision and with such a dispassionate view to what is the reality of it and what the spiritual need is that people are just often astonished. And God's not up there agonizing over it like you may be because you happen to love the person. God just says, okay, this person's become too much of a problem. He's like in that regard, he uses the deal of the husbandman, the farmer. What's he do? He goes out there and just picks the branches he doesn't like and cuts them off. Why? Because he's got a bigger end in view. He's looking for productivity. If it's not there, eventually, quack. Piles them all up. You're no good, you're no good, you're no good. Burns them. And that's it. Their phase two's toast. And their phase three, a lot of it's toast too. They just don't know it yet. They haven't woke up to it. Well, here, this the Corinthian believer was maladjusted. And the goal of all this was to say, you better come to your spiritual senses. You don't. And see, what was he going to do? Say, well, I'll just go to another church in Corinth. Well, apparently there wasn't one. And Corinth was a pretty large city. Why didn't he just move off to another church and say, well, I don't have to obey Paul? Well, number one, he's still in Paul's canon. And do you think Paul would have let that fly? Oh, you've blown off the apostolic authority and you think you're going to play this card. I think Paul would have been right on his tail. And I think he would have been facing the same thing that he was facing in this church. Hey, this guy's doing this. He's not to be accepted. Well, Paul says, look, this guy here did. He recovered. Verse 6, sufficient for such a one is the punishment which was inflicted by the majority. The majority in a local church who has their spiritual act together, who is growing in the right direction, they become, sort of a sense, a law. Because they've achieved a certain amount of spiritual growth. They have a certain set of standards that they believe are necessary to function properly in the angelic conflict. And when one gets at odds with that law, guess what? They're at odds with God. And you say, well, I'm only at odds with the pastor and the local church. Nope, you're at odds with God. There's no question about it. So that on the contrary, you should rather forgive and comfort him. That's the goal. The goal is restoration. Otherwise, such a one might be overwhelmed by excessive sorrow. So while we want people to recover, we want, you know, obviously at some level, you just have to respect volition. And if they're negative and they're going to stay negative, there's nothing I can do about it. It's not that I like it, but what am I going to do? I can't kill myself over it. Well, 3, to fulfill the commands to apply it. This is, well, obviously you got the royal imperatives to apply. And thus remain within the directive will of God. That's another good reason to apply this. So there's a self-preservation reason here to protect yourself from corrupting influences. There's an ambassadorial reason, we might say, because you're trying to function as an ambassador and let people know, hey, you're messed up with God. You've crossed the line with God here. And then there's the whole personal function to just stay within God's will and to continue your own spiritual advance. So there are many good reasons to apply this. Again, the hardest ones to apply this are with the closest personal relationships. If you don't have any emotional attachment, it's more easy to apply the doctrine. It's where the emotional attachment exists that one has to get beyond that and say, okay, I know what the doctrine says. See, failure to apply this doctrine impartially adversely affects spiritual growth and the witness of the life. Now, one should avoid all associations that compromise doctrine. Again, you wouldn't go out and join the Masons or some other secret organization. These associations compromise doctrine. And certain of these other things compromise doctrine. As we've seen, they may not be as bad as the Masons. They may not be actually teaching false doctrine, but these associations with fundies. What I've observed over the years is the people that are out there listening to other teachers often degenerate. You say, well, I was only listening to another guy who was teaching doctrine. Okay. Why? The only reason would be if your pastor wasn't doing the job. Now, is he doing the job? Yeah. Well, I don't need to be listening to anybody else. Okay, so let's say you were doing that. What I've observed in these people is they deteriorate. What becomes one person they're listening to suddenly becomes another book they're reading, suddenly becomes another person. Then pretty soon you're listening to Focus on the Family. Then the next thing you know, you're a screaming fundy. And I've seen people go down this path. I've observed it. And all the while thinking, well, this is all okay. Well, you have to apply it impartially. That's the big deal. And that's where it gets tough. This is, again, where the spiritual rubber meets the road. So what's going to compromise doctrine? Well, I've been studying thus and such, and he doesn't believe that separation's a real issue. Really? Huh. Funny. All the studying I've done kind of leads me to believe just the opposite, that it is. D, when dealing with other positive believers in the local church, recognize that failure in a particular area, which is not severe enough to present to the leadership, is not grounds for separation. Generally speaking, if people are positive and they're all moving in the same direction, what would there need to be a reason to separate for? The separation becomes when one sheep becomes a law to his or herself. And then ultimately the flock, in many cases, again, this whole doctrine of separation, the sheep goes off over here. The sheep actually has instigated the separation, but they want to blame somebody else. That's what I've observed with people, too. It's always somebody else's fault. There's no personal responsibility with a lot of these people. It's not my fault. This is somebody else's fault. The blame goes elsewhere. And this is the sheep that wanders off, does his own little thing. And then ultimately, because then when he gets either disciplined or reined back in by the shepherd, he either rebels or he responds to it properly and says, you know what? The shepherd's right. I need to be doing this. I need to stick with the flock here. I was in danger out there. The wolves could have picked me off. I was stupid. And so if he comes to his senses, of course, and that's the deal, the whole goal is to keep the flock, generally speaking, together and moving in the same direction. That's the goal of a shepherd. To take them to pasture, to provide the spiritual nourishment necessary for spiritual growth, and all of that. So if people are in the local church, generally here, applying, and you don't have any major big, you know, they're not engaged in overt immorality, they're not out there selling crack or doing, you know, 90 other things that you could be doing to get into trouble, then generally speaking, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. They start advocating false doctrine, they start doing all kinds of other stuff. Well, that's a different deal now. I have to deal with that differently. But to the extent that they become a real threat to the sanctity and the security of the local church, and they become a wolf in sheep's clothing, they, you know, this kind of thing, well, you're going to have to deal with that. So again, with other positive believers, my deal is I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt first. Till I'm forced to have to deal with it. Now, if you force me to have to deal with it, I'll deal with it. But it won't be my first choice. I'll try to let people grow through their stuff. Okay, maybe they can get past all this. Maybe they can't. If they can't, they're just dead wood on the tree, and eventually, you know, the husbandman's going to chop them off anyway. It's only a matter of time. So, generally speaking, if people are in class pursuing their most pressing responsibility, which is growing up spiritually, that's what you're supposed to be doing, are oriented to the pulpit and applying, there is no reason to separate from them. Now, you may not like their personality. That's not a good reason. Was there any point in here on personality being a reason for separation? It's not. You may not like certain things they do. Maybe they sin in areas that are offensive to you. Always remember, you sin in areas that are offensive to other believers too. And we put up with you. Well, guess what? People have their areas of weakness, their areas of strength. They're going to do things you don't like. That's all just a part of the big family deal. I mean, did you always get along with everybody in your family? When you were growing up, let's say you were 10, 12 years old, or did you say, you know, I'm getting out of this group, a bunch of nut jobs. And maybe they were a bunch of nut jobs. But no, you put up with certain things. You know, I remember wanting to knock my little brother's head off, but I always had this fear of my dad. He said, if you do it, you don't hit your little brothers or I'm going to whack you. I said, okay. So I had to put up with it. And, you know, they do bad things and they got away with it. But I was the oldest, so I was held to a higher standard. Well, guess what? If people are generally oriented, they don't have to be perfectly oriented, then I'm for them and you should be for them. And God's for them. Again, if they've got big issues, they're constantly oriented, they're constantly maladjusted to the pulpit, constantly challenging the doctrine, that's a different deal. That's not the average believer here, though. There's no reason, again, I see to separate from them. There isn't anybody here I would separate from, I can tell you that. Even if they're struggling, I'm going to pray for them and hope they make it. And if they blow it, well then, what have I been hurt by that? That didn't hurt me. I prayed for them. I did the right thing. Well, F, in any questionable situations, pursue God's will through prayer, attendance in Bible class, seeking divine guidance, and He will bless your mental attitude, desire to please Him. I'm fully convinced of that. If God doesn't bless, and those who want to please Him, well, who's He going to bless? And if you're a positive believer that's doing the right things and praying about it and all of that, God will work out the details. Now, the details may not be worked out quickly. You may go through a period where you have to put up with certain things. It may take months, maybe even years, for God to work out certain details. But let God work them out. You pray about it. You faith rest it. You relax. And guess what? That's another thing. As we're coming down to the end of Ecclesiastes, Solomon's going to articulate the same thing. Just have a relaxed mental attitude about it. Don't get so wrapped around the axle about stuff. It's easy to do that. And I think when I first did this, when I had in here and I had my little deal, WWRD, what would Ron do? So would Ron go into this deal? What do I think Ron would do? Well, Ron, see, is your physical example. He's not perfect, but he's a physical example. And one would have to consider that. And I knew certain people when I'd said that. Matter of fact, it was kind of a joke. I don't expect you to stop and think every time, what would Ron do? It was kind of a joke. But certain people, you should have seen the look on their face when I taught it. No, I know what Ron would do. In many cases, people would avoid talking to me about it because they knew what I thought. And they said, well, you know, I don't want to hear that because I want to do this and such. I think it's okay to skip class to go to a Backstreet Boys concert. Yeah, they're still doing pretty good, I guess, aren't they? Oh, no, I guess they're not even together anymore. And you gave up doctrine and eternal issues for that? No, not impressed, sorry. But would Ron skip class to go to a concert? Yeah, I've canceled class lots of times for concerts. No. Ever? No. No, there's lots of things I'd like to do. You know, they've had wine tastings I wanted to go to on Thursday. Guess what? I bit the bullet just like everybody else has to. Had class. And different things you'd like to do. I understand that. Well, as you make these sacrifices, God sees it. And God's glorified. And he blesses those that are willing to do that and put his plan first. And guess what? I didn't get to see the Backstreet Boys. How shall I live? I'm not sure life can go on. Oh, wait a minute. Don't worry. They'll be back next year if they're still together. And even if you miss it, I mean, you know, and of course, various times I had, you know, younger people here, you know, and I had to listen to the New Kids on the Block. And every new stupid thing that came along, I had to put up with for years. Because people, parents wouldn't deal with this stuff. And so I ended up having to deal with it. Well, that's too bad. Well, gee, when you come under pressure by separating from the negative or lukewarm, remember Proverbs 24, verses 19 and 20. And you may get certain amount of pressures. You may have certain things that happen. I'm fully convinced the harder the doctrine is to apply, the more God blesses those who do it. If you had children, which would you rather have, a disobedient child or an obedient child? I think all of us in our right minds would say, well, we'd rather have an obedient child. Well, what if your child was obedient even to the extent that it cost him a great deal? Well, you'd be even more proud of him, wouldn't you think? I would. People sacrificed a great deal to fulfill God's plan. Well, Proverbs 24:19 and 20, do not fret because of evildoers, or be envious because of the wicked. For there will be no future for the evil man, and the lamp of the wicked will be put out. We know that the negative are going to come to nothing ultimately. Now, less than nothing. They're going to end up in the lake of fire. And spiritually, what the negative believer is going to be in heaven, I don't know, but I don't want to find out. I'll let them find out. I don't want to find out. So don't, you know, again, you're going to see people prospering, people violating this doctrine, getting away with it. This is the challenge of Ecclesiastes. How do we deal with a world where many of these principles we know to be true don't seem to be true? Do we throw away our faith in the principles? Do we just say, well, hey, God's not blessing this enough for me. I'm not applying it. Or do you take the hard stand and do the right thing and endure the slings and arrows and all that? Well, H, further remember the blessings that are promised to those that apply this doctrine. Psalm 1. Intriguing, isn't it? Here's the Psalms. Here's David. He wrote most of them, not all of them, but most of them. What becomes the first issue in the first Psalm? Separation. Go figure. How could it be that important? It is that important. How blessed is the man? Again, the noun Esher, which is always found in the plural construct form in the Old Testament. And it literally means the blessings, or the blessednesses is probably better, but that's not a word you would use a lot. Or the bliss. How blissful is the man? You could translate it like that, almost like an adverb. How blissful is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked? In other words, he doesn't take advice from those that are enemies of God. Why would anyone take advice from somebody who's an enemy of God? A positive believer would find that reprehensible, I would think. Why would you do that? When I ever have a problem, I don't consult any unbelievers about my problem. Well, I'll take it back. If I go to the doctor and I have a problem, I don't care if he's a believer or unbeliever. I just want him to be qualified. I don't agonize about that. But when I seek advice about something, and I don't seek that much advice from other people. I mean, I do when I think I need to. Not arrogant about it, but generally speaking, I mean, I'm almost 55. I've got a lot of stuff figured out by now. And, I mean, not to say I never could use advice or direction. I've profited greatly from advice and direction. And some of it was very difficult for me to hear, frankly. But you humble yourself, you listen to it, and you go on. But I don't take my advice from the wicked. You know, they have a deal every night now. Of course, since a financial crisis going on, they have a deal on channel, you know, 4 or 7, our local one. Call in, talk to an expert. By the way, you know what an expert is? It's somebody from out of town. That's all you got to do to be an expert. Just be from out of town. That used to be one of our standing jokes when we were fundy evangelists. Oh, you should have seen me. I was great. That's when we realized, why do these people listen to us? Why do they think we're so great? Because we're from out of town. And so we must be cool. Well, he's an expert, but based on whose standards? And so they'll have him call in. Well, I'm not going to call and ask him, Richard Stern, what do you think I should do? And, pass. Not interested. Won't call Rush Limbaugh and check out and see what he thinks. Or any of the other experts. Dr. Phil. How shall I live, Dr. Phil? Oh, God, I can't even stand that guy's voice, let alone him. Well, nor do they stand in the path of sinners. They avoid certain highways, as we might say, and byways where these people frequent. We know where these people hang out. I don't really go up, you know, or I've driven by the Cheetah Club. I know the Cheetah Club is there. I've never gone in. I've never had a desire to go in. See, once I was a believer, I didn't want to sin no more. Just kidding. I didn't want to sin any longer. So the point is, you don't frequent certain places, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. Here's where they become even more comfortable now. Now they're not only taking advice, standing. Now we see them comfortable sitting down. Now they're comfortable with the negative. That's not good. But his delight is in the law of the Lord. And in his law he meditates day and night. He will be like a tree firmly planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither, and in whatever he does, he prospers. That's the one I want to be. And in contrast to the wicked are not so in the following verse. They're like the chaff which the wind drives away. They're light, they're useless. They're absolutely useless. And the chaff is not even worth keeping. And the wind represents judgment. The judgment comes, and the wicked are no more. And that's what it says repeatedly throughout the Bible. Well, Mark 10, 28 through 31, I believe that's our one where you're promised all the blessings, both in time and in eternity. Say, well, I've been applying doctrine for this doctrine for years, and I don't have mine. Well, be patient. Pardon me, he didn't say you were going to get it immediately. Yeah, this is the one who has left. No one has left who has left house or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or farms for my sake and for the gospel's sake, but that he will receive 100 times as much now in the present age. I would have to say, even in my relatively limited niche, I've seen this verse come true in my life. I remember when we first moved down here and we left family, friends, local church that was properly functioning. And every poor little pastor that gets called that there is sufficient positive volition and he ever gets a church, he walks in and he finds out, I remember one, and I won't say who it was, I don't want to embarrass anybody, but this one guy was candidating at this one church, and I got to talk to him and his wife while they were candidating, and the first thing she told me, she said, "Oh my God, Ron, they're fundies." Well, what'd you think you were going to get? A perfectly squared away local church that has all the doctrine straight? No. You come out of an environment in which everything is structured, organized, people have applied and applied at a high level, like the church we came out of, Maranatha, and things, you know, and it worked. And, you know, they have their problems like any other church, but things ran, generally speaking, very smoothly. And things were taken care of, applications were made, and all of that. They've been there to apply, certainly, in terms of living grace and other things, even towards other local churches. And then on top of that, set up and ran 2 seminaries. You have to be pretty organized to handle a seminary, trust me. It's a big job to be able to even have the stuff there, the people to teach and all that. So we left there. I got here. We came down. Naive, young, stupid. And I say naive, I was 35, I was a little, still pretty relatively young. And I looked at it and I thought, oh, well, we get down here, you know, I can't find a job, we're poor, we're broke. We don't have, literally, at the end of the week, if you had a dollar left in the bank, you were still on the plus side, and that was good enough. And then God provided me a job, horrible, God-awful job, but it was a job. I mean, delivering cabinets in the heat of the Florida sun. And this was, 89 was brutal for those. If you watch on TV, you'll see many of the records were set in 1989. It was a brutal summer that year. I don't think it really cooled off under 90 hardly till like Thanksgiving that year. And so I had this, and we're able to teach three Bible classes. I've got a job. Okay, we're making ends meet and all that. We don't have any money. You know, literally, sometimes we were like a nickel from broke. Was I unhappy? No, I wasn't unhappy. I didn't agonize over it. But then over the years, you know, 20 years later, now I look back and I think, oh, geez, I actually have some money in the bank. God has actually brought all this to pass. I'm surrounded by positive believers rather than hangers-on and twits. And to me, that's far better than anything I could have done. And he's provided jobs. He's provided whatever I needed at any given time. And it wasn't quick. Didn't come overnight. And then I come to find out some believers sitting out there in the congregation resent that I even have anything. Well, that's pathetic. That is absolutely pathetic. Here's some guy who's applied the hard doctrine, done all this stuff, and you're jealous that he's got something? That is pathetic. I've heard this kind of talk, and I mean, this is nonsense. This has completely missed the point of this verse. And you know what? God could take it all away tomorrow. I always bear that in mind, too. I don't look at this stuff and think, oh, well, God, you know, God's obligated to you now. He's not obligated to me. I fully believe that everything you get comes from the source of grace. But what he's saying is, you apply this doctrine, I'm going to grace you out. I'm going to bless you. And if you don't, there's no guarantees. The guarantees come for the application. But that he will receive 100 times as much now in the present age. So really, at the end of the week, you know, if I only had a nickel, he only really had to give me like $50. And he would have fulfilled the verse. 100 times that. Or no, that would only be $5, wouldn't it? Well, see, it didn't take much to fulfill it if you're really flat broke. Well, God blessed all this. And then to hear believers stand around and gripe about it, you got to be kidding me. How petty is that? So if anybody, and I've prayed for years, my prayer always still is the same one it's always been. I haven't changed it. I pray for every one of you. You'll prosper and be in good health even as your soul prospers. But the soul prosperity's got to come first. And so you apply this and you come under some great big blessing, well, I'm going to be happy for you. I'm not going to be petty and sitting around, who are they? How come God isn't blessing me? You're pathetic. Grow up. That's not even humanly mature. Let alone spiritually mature. So here you'll get all of this, brothers, sisters, children, farms, along with persecutions. And in the age to come, eternal life. So I assume the age to come, the eternal life blessing, while mentioned last here, and really the smallest of the things, is the greatest of the things. The whole experience of the eternal life niche in a maximum fashion. Not just being there, but being in the middle of it. And enjoying it. And 2 Corinthians 6, 16 through 18, that's the last one where he says essentially, and these promises again may not look like much on the surface, but one needs to reflect on these and think about them and what it means. So if we separate, the middle of verse 16, I will dwell in them and walk among them. Now you're talking about a personal relationship with God at a level that your average believer is not getting. That this goes beyond just simply you're saved and God's for you. This is God visibly manifesting that he is for you. And we're not visibly, I mean, we're not going to see God per se. But that's the thing. If you're a positive believer, you see God in the little intimate details that nobody else really gets to see. There's a certain secrecy about the Christian life at that level. God doesn't just reveal himself to anybody. And when he does reveal himself to people, that is what constitutes, in fact, real life. The relationship with him. Therefore, I will be their God, and they will be my people. Therefore, come out from their midst and be separate. Says the Lord, and do not touch what is unclean, and I will welcome you. I.e., I won't welcome you if you do these things. He never promises to welcome believers that don't apply this doctrine. And I will be a father to you. Well, isn't God a father to everybody? Clearly, this verse must go beyond just the normal blessings of the Christian life. I will be a father to you, and you will be sons and daughters to me, says the Lord Almighty. Therefore, having these promises, now let us cleanse ourselves. Now we have some phase two applications off of these great blessings. So if you want God to be for you, this doctrine's going to have to be a part of your repertoire. You're going to have to know it. You're going to have to learn it, how to apply it, when to apply it, and all of that. Okay, well, our time's up. We'll stop there. We're ready to get back to the text on Wednesday. And so we will pick back up in Ecclesiastes 10, verse 4. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of this time together. We pray you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.
Session.